Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
It's great to be diving into the materials you've sent us.
Today, we're really getting into something fundamental. Limestone, looking at its foundational role in, well, ancient architecture all across the globe.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. We've got a great collection of sources here, looking at everything from the geology of the rock itself.
Right.
To how different ancient cultures used it, the technologies they developed.
And its legacy, which is still very much with us.
Exactly. So our plan today is to sort of unpack the key takeaways from these sources.
Highlighting maybe some surprising ways limestone really shaped the ancient world. We'll look at its composition, how they used it, even what it might have symbolized.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. Limestone. It seems almost ubiquitous in ancient construction, doesn't it? What exactly is this material they were building with?
Fundamentally, it's a sedimentary rock, apparently the third most common type, which explains a lot about its widespread use.
And the key ingredient is calcium carbonate, right? Usually calcite or aragonite minerals.
Yeah, same chemical formula, KCO3, but different crystal structures. Interesting detail.
So how does it form? I mean, they weren't just finding perfect blocks ready to go, were they?
Usually not, no. The sources mention a few ways. Chemical precipitation from water.
Like hard water deposits, but on a geological scale.
Kind of, yeah. And also biochemically, which I find amazing. The buildup of shells, corals, tiny marine organisms over millions of years.
So ancient sea life literally becoming building blocks.
Exactly. And then there's mechanical redeposition bits of older limestone getting moved around and reformed. Most modern limestone forms in shallow seas, apparently, like the Bahamas.
A direct link between biology and geology, right there in the stone. But it's not pure calcium carbonate, is it? There's other stuff mixed in.
That's right. Often magnesium carbonate leading to dolomitic limestone. Plus, you know, bits of clay, iron, feldspar, quartz.
And those impurities affect the color, the texture, even the durability.
Which means ancient builders had to be pretty savvy geologists, in a practical sense. They had to understand the stone they were working with.
And you mentioned the marine organism, so fossils are common.
Very common. So looking at an old limestone wall, you might literally be looking at shells from millions of years ago. It connects the building directly to deep time.
That's quite profound. Now, the sources talk about different types of limestone. Can we go through some key ones relevant to building?
Sure. There's travertine. It's crystalline, often banded, a bit porous.
The Romans loved that, didn't they? For things like the Colosseum.
Exactly. Dimension stone, decoration, paving. The Pantheon uses it too. Then you have tufa.
Which is lighter, more porous.
Yeah. Forms quickly near springs. Good for general building, maybe infill. Used in the Loire Valley, parts of the Colosseum too.
Okay. What about chalk? That seems too soft for big structures.
Primarily, yeah. Very fine-grained, high calcium carbonate. Its main ancient use seems to have been as a source for quicklime, vital for mortar and plaster, though some sources mention it in house construction in places like ancient England.
Ah, the crucial lime connection. We'll come back to that. What else?
Fossiliferous limestone, packed with visible fossils, used for building but also decoration, like Purbeck marble in the UK. A way to showcase ancient life.
Almost like natural art embedded in the stone.
Right. Then there's oolitic limestone, made of tiny cemented spheres called oids.
That sounds more uniform.
It is, often even grained, easy to work. Great for high-quality carving, facades, monuments. Think Bath stone, Cotswold stone. Some even suggest the Great Pyramid's core might be oolitic.
Wow, the pyramid core. Okay, keep going.
Coquina, basically loosely cemented shells, very porous. Used where better stone was scarce, like coastal Florida later on.
A sort of necessity-driven choice.
Seems like it. Lithographic limestone, hard, fine-grained, dense. Famous for printing, but maybe used for fine carving. Solnhofen limestone is the example given.
Less common for large structures, perhaps.
Probably. And finally, crystalline limestone. A broad category, includes marble, but also non-metamorphosed types. Can be durable, polishable. Think Greek temples, though that's often marble.
So, a huge variety. The ancients weren't just grabbing any limestone. They were selecting specific types for specific jobs.
Absolutely. Fine tura for the pyramid casings, durable travertine for Roman monuments, workable oolitic for carvings, chalk for lime. It was material science, really, learned through experience.
And certain regions became known for their specific types, shaping local building styles.
Definitely. Tura and Mokattam in Egypt, Melekin, Jerusalem, Kachin in France, Portland in the UK. Local geology drove architectural traditions.
Okay, zooming out slightly. What were the general properties that made limestone such a go-to material across so many cultures?
Well, number one, probably its abundance and availability. It's common globally, often found locally, which massively reduce transport headaches.
A huge factor when you're moving multi-ton blocks.
For sure. Then, workability. Compared to granite or basalt, it's relatively soft. Easier to cut, carve, shape with the tools they had: stone, copper, bronze, later iron.
Which enabled things like those precisely cut ashlar blocks we see?
Yes, and detailed decoration. But it also had to last.
Right. Durability. Many limestone structures have stood for millennia.
When chosen well, yeah. Pyramids, Parthenon, Colosseum. It offered good structural integrity, too. Good compressive strength for walls, foundations, columns, arches.
It looks good, presumably.
Aesthetic appeal, definitely.
Yeah.
Different colors, textures, some polishable, plus other benefits, maybe secondary, but useful. Thermal insulation, helping regulate temperature.
Acting like thermal mass.
Exactly. It's fire-resistant, non-combustible. And provide some sound insulation.
And critically, the source of lime for mortars and plasters.
Can't overstate that. Limestone heated becomes quicklime, add water, you get hydrated, the line of binder for so much ancient masonry and finishing work.
So it really hit a sweet spot, didn't it? Durable enough, but workable enough. The Goldilocks material.
That's a perfect way to put it. A practical compromise between super hard stone like granite, which was a nightmare to work, and less permanent materials like mud brick. This balance enabled the sheer scale and longevity we see.
Though, as you said, cultural priorities might shift that balance, maybe favoring extreme durability over workability sometimes.
True. But for many, limestone offered that ideal blend. Okay, let's look at specific examples. Ancient Egypt, the scale is just mind-boggling. How did they leverage limestone?
They really used it strategically. As you said, limestone was for eternal structures, tombs, temples. Mud brick was for the living world, palaces, towns. They had access to fantastic limestone quarries along the Nile, like Tura and Mokattam.
The pyramids are the obvious example. Limestone through and through.
Mostly. The massive core was often local, rougher limestone blocks, sometimes with rubble fill. But the outer casing, the bit that made them gleam, was typically that fine white Tura limestone.
Transported from quarries further away.
Yes, often floated down the Nile on barges. We even have records, like the Diary of Merer, describing this process, transporting millions of tons of Tura casing stone for the Great Pyramid alone. It's staggering.
And that white casing wasn't just for looks, was it?
No, deeply symbolic. It represented purity, connection to the sun god Ra. Imagine these structures, perfectly smooth, reflecting the desert sun. A powerful statement. Even the Sphinx is carved from the local Mokattam bedrock.
What about joining the blocks? Did they use lime mortar?
Interestingly, not so much for the core blocks in the early periods. They often used gypsum mortar or just rubble fill between the core stones. Lime mortar became more common later, especially in the Roman period. For mud bricks, they used Nile mud.
So the choice of limestone itself was the primary statement of permanence. Let's jump across the Mediterranean to Greece. Famous for marble, but limestone played a part.
A crucial early part. The Acropolis itself is a limestone hill. Limestone formed the foundations for the Parthenon and other temples. Many early significant structures were built entirely of local limestones before marble became the prestige material.
And their techniques were different from the Egyptians.
Very much focused on precision joining. Often dry stone masonry fitting blocks so perfectly that mortar wasn't the primary structural element.
How did they achieve that fit?
Techniques like anathrosis, dressing the edges of joining surfaces meticulously while recessing the center slightly. Perfect flatbeds for horizontal joints. They aimed for harmonia, a perfect fit reflecting philosophical ideals.
But they did use reinforcements.
Oh, yes. Iron clamps, often H-shaped, and dowels, usually set in molten lead poured into carved channels to lock blocks together horizontally and vertically. Crucial for stability, especially against earthquakes.
Still, that precision without mortar is amazing. Did they use lime at all?
Yes, for lime plasters and stuccos, which could be painted, and for mortars in other contexts, just not typically as the main bonding agent for their finest ashlar walls. Their mastery of working limestone definitely paved the way for their later work in marble.
Right. Now, the Romans, empire builders, limestone must have been key.
Absolutely fundamental. They used vast quantities of it across the empire for everything. Amphitheaters, temples, aqueducts, bridges, roads, concrete aggregate, you name it. They used local types, but also prized specific ones like travertine from Tivoli.
The Colosseum, the Pont du Gard, iconic limestone structures.
Exactly. But their real game changer was how they used lime.
Roman concrete.
Precisely. Opus caementitium. They mastered large-scale lime production and, crucially, developed hydraulic lime by adding pozzolanic materials, like volcanic ash.
Which let it set underwater, right?
Yes, and made it incredibly strong and durable. And limestone wasn't just the source of the lime. Crushed limestone was often a key aggregate within the concrete itself, contributing to its strength.
So limestone was baked to make the binder and also mixed into the concrete itself.
Double contribution.
Yeah.
This concrete technology allowed them to build vaults, domes like the Pantheon, massive infrastructure on an unprecedented scale. And they needed huge, organized quarrying operations to supply it.
The scale is just immense. It must have had a huge environmental footprint even back then.
That's a really interesting point. Those sources don't delve into much. But yes, quarrying on that scale would certainly have impacted local landscapes significantly.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing.
This smells fantastic today. A lovely blend of spices.
Let's see.
It's got a good strength to it. Not too milky. Just a touch bitter, though. Maybe a little more sugar would bring out the sweetness.
I see what you mean. Still very welcome, though.
Definitely. Let's take a quick pause to enjoy this. Welcome back. Feeling nicely refreshed.
Indeed. Ready to continue our journey.
Okay, we've covered the Mediterranean giants. Let's head to Mesoamerica, the Maya. What was limestone's role in their incredible cities?
Well, the Yucatan Peninsula is basically a massive limestone platform, so it was the primary building material for the Maya. Pyramids, temples, palaces, stelae, ball courts, even the raised roads, the Sacbeob, all limestone.
How did they build with it? Similar techniques?
Some similarities, some differences. They often used dressed-facing stones over a core of rubble held together with lime mortar, a kind of Mayan concrete.
Ah, mortar again.
Yes, and very characteristic feature was the corbelled vault. Not a true arch, but overlapping stones to roof spaces. It worked, but tended to create narrow rooms with thick walls. Later, the Puuc style used clever boot-shaped veneer stones for vaults.
And lime was important for them, too.
Hugely important. Evidence suggests they were producing lime in pit kilns as early as 1100 BCE. It was essential for their mortars, and especially for the thick layers of plaster, or stucco, that covered nearly everything.
And they decorated the stucco.
Elaborately. Moderate reliefs, bright paint. They even developed a type of pozzolanic cement, mixing lime with volcanic ash, similar in principle to the Romans, but developed independently.
Amazing. So lime was structural and decorative.
And more. They used lime for nixtamalization, treating maize to unlock its nutritional value, a fundamental part of their diet and culture. It really permeated their civilization. Some even think acoustic effects in limestone structures, like the Kukulcan Pyramid Echo, had religious meaning.
Wow. Okay, let's move east now to the Indus Valley Civilization. What's the limestone story there?
Limestone wasn't maybe the dominant facade material like in Egypt, but it was used for significant elements, especially at sites like Dolavira and Harappa. Pillar components, large ringstones, drain covers, some adornments.
Tell me about these ringstones. They sound mysterious.
They are a bit. Large, circular limestone pieces. Their function is debated, maybe pillar bases, maybe stacked elements themselves. Some sources mention limestone being transported over long distances to sites like Harappa, showing complex networks.
So maybe more symbolic or status-related than purely structural.
Quite possibly. Displaying control over resources and labor to quarry, shape, and transport these large, specific limestone objects seems likely to have held ritual or power significance.
Interesting. Okay, one more stop. Prehistoric Malta, some of the oldest stone structures anywhere.
Truly remarkable. The megalithic temples, built thousands of years BCE, entirely from local limestone, and crucially without any metal tools.
Just stone tools. How did they manage what kind of limestone?
They cleverly used two main types, a harder Coralline limestone for the outer walls and massive uprights, the orthostats, and a softer Globigerina limestone for the interiors and for carving.
So they understood the different properties even then.
Absolutely. Their building techniques involved these huge orthostats, infill between walls for stability, and likely corbelled roofing. The intricate carvings on the softer Globigerina spirals, annals done purely with stone tools like flint and obsidian, are just incredible.
It really highlights the ingenuity involved in just getting the stone. How did they quarry and move the stuff across these different cultures?
It was always intensely manual, using relatively simple tools, at least initially. Stone hammers, chisels of flint, then copper, bronze, and eventually iron. Wedges, both wood and metal, were key.
Did the techniques vary much?
The principles were similar. Isolate the block, often by cutting trenches, then use leverage or wedges to split it free. Egyptians used chisels, drills, saws. Greeks focused on natural cleavage planes. Romans scaled everything up with iron tools. Maya used wedges, levers, maybe fire setting. Malta relied purely on stone tools and exploiting fissures. The Indus Valley had that interesting block-on-block shaping technique.
The evolution of tool materials, copper, bronze, iron, must have made a huge difference.
Immense difference in efficiency. But moving the blocks was another colossal challenge.
How did they manage that?
Ingenuity and sheer manpower. Egyptians used sledges, famously lubricated with water, on prepared tracks or ramps, plus Nile boats. Greeks used sea transport, carts, ramps, maybe early cranes. Romans used slipways, wagons, ships, cranes again, massive scale. Maya used rollers, sledges, ropes, potentially river transport, but lots of manual hauling.
No draft animals in Mesoamerica, right?
Right. That makes their achievements even more impressive. Malta likely used rollers, levers, and possibly stone balls, acting like bearings under the megaliths.
Yeah.
Indus Valley probably used rollers and manpower. Water transport was always a huge advantage where available.
Okay, so they get the block to the site, then shaping and fitting.
Techniques varied again. Egyptians dressed casing stones perfectly smooth, left coarse stones rougher, used gypsum mortar or rubble fill. Greeks, as we said, aimed for that precise dry fit with anatharosis, clamps, and dowels.
Romans built on Greek techniques, but added their advanced lime mortars and concrete, though still used dry joints too.
Exactly. Maya shaped facing stones over a mortared rubble core, used turd obsidian tools, and covered everything in lime plaster. Indus Valley shaped with block on block, maybe used wooden pegs. Malta carved the soft Globigerina with stone obsidian, used dry construction with infill.
That development of lime mortars and cements seems like a recurring technological leap.
Absolutely.
Huh.
It really unlocked new structural forms and improved durability significantly. And then the final surface treatments, polishing, carving, plastering, painting, serve functional, aesthetic, and symbolic purposes.
Which brings us to that whole layer of meaning. These weren't just buildings.
Not at all. They were expressions of culture, belief, power. In Egypt, the white Tura limestone symbolized Ra, purity, eternity, contrasting with transient mud brick. For the Greeks, limestone and marble embodied beauty, divinity, civic ideals. Harmonia reflected philosophical order.
Romans used travertine and marble to project the power and grandeur of the state.
And the Maya. Acoustics possibly linked to gods, steely recording history and cosmic connections. Lime itself a symbol of innovation. Even in the Indus Valley, those large limestone objects likely signaled status and connections. That gleaming white finish seems universally potent.
A beacon connecting earth and sky, almost?
You could say that. It required immense effort, transforming the stone into something radiant. But these amazing structures aren't immune to time.
No, limestone does decay, doesn't it? What are the main culprits?
Its calcium carbonate nature makes it vulnerable. Chemical weathering from acid rain dissolves it. Physical weathering, freeze-thaw, salt crystallization expanding in pores, thermal stress, wind abrasion, and biological weathering algae, lichens, plant roots.
We see the effects everywhere. The Acropolis showing dissolution, the pyramids eroded, the Colosseum weathered and grayed.
Exactly. Mortar fails, joints open, the stone surface crumbles or sugars, cracks appear, pieces fall off, especially if there's corroding metal inside. It's the paradox. Its reactivity is useful, but also its remnants. Local climate and pollution play huge roles.
So conserving these treasures is a massive challenge. How do they approach it?
The goal is preserving the fabric and its significance, balancing authenticity and stability. It's tricky due to limestone's porosity and the weight involved.
What are some common techniques?
Traditional methods include careful mortar repairs, repointing, using compatible softer lime mortars, avoiding hard cement. Stone consolidation using chemicals to strengthen crumbling stone, though compatibility is key. Stone repair with patches or fillers or replacement of severely damaged blocks, ideally with stone from the original quarry. And gentle cleaning methods.
Are there newer approaches?
Yes. Things like laser cleaning for precise removal of crusts and nanolime consolidation where tiny calcium hydroxide particles penetrate and carbonate within the stone to bind it. Understanding the root cause of decay is vital. As is managing water.
And there are ethical considerations too, right? How much to intervene?
Always. The ideal is minimal, compatible, and reversible intervention. We've learned hard lessons from past mistakes, like damaging iron clamps used in restorations. There's a growing appreciation for using traditional lime-based materials that work sympathetically with the original structure.
It's a continuous process of learning and care. So as we wrap up this exploration, it's clear Limestone wasn't just a material, it was often the material that enabled ancient civilizations to build their world.
Absolutely. From the grandest monuments to everyday uses, its unique properties were understood and exploited with incredible skill and ingenuity.
Just think about the sheer human effort, the logistics of quarrying and moving those stones without modern tech,
right,
and the depth of practical material knowledge they developed.
Choosing the right stone for the job, developing lime technology, it's impressive empirical science.
And the symbolic weight these structures carried, embodying power, faith, identity in ways that still speak to us.
Definitely. And the ongoing conservation efforts are a constant reminder of the dialogue between human creation and the natural forces of time and decay. The story isn't over.
Thank you for joining us on the Curtis Research Audio Archive for this look into ancient limestone. We hope it sparked some thoughts.
What aspects of this ancient technology surprised you the most? Is there wisdom from their material use that we could perhaps relearn today?
We always look forward to your curiosity and the sources you might share with us for future explorations.